Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey friends, my name is Andre and this is the Tennis and Bagels podcast. We have been pretty privileged the last few months, I guess, to be able to have the full team together. And here today we got Owen. How are you doing, man?
Doing well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. And Vansh is here with us again.
Yep, I'm doing great. Yeah, really looking forward to this episode. It was nice when the three of us are back together.
Yeah, exactly. And we have here a very special guest, like somebody who's here for the first time. He mostly covers the Challenger Tours, which is going to be the talk of today because the new season is coming up. And if you remember Aslan Karatsev and Carlos Alcaraz, they all had to go through big wins in the Challenger Tours. So we're going to be touching base on that today with the expert on the Challenger Tours, Damian Kust. I'm probably butchered your name, so if you want to say your name again.
It's fine. I mean, in Poland, we usually just say Damian Kust, but... Yeah, Damian is fine as well because that's what English speaking people are used to. But yes, hello. I actually didn't know that it was going to be the full gang, but yeah. I'm happy to see you all.
Yeah, sorry, I'm still getting the hang of giving all the important details, I guess. But you know, you know these guys better than you know me, so it's probably better than in any case.
Yeah, I mean,
I mean, we're usually super prepared here, so like, you know, this is like the only time we mess things up. I'm kidding. We usually do a lot of preparation, but yeah, it's great to have you here.
Yeah, and yeah, we have prepared a few questions, and our goal today, I think, is really as I mentioned, to kind of chat a bit about players who are coming up in the Challenger Tours and just really the experience because it's kind of an underappreciated tour and most of the time just really forgotten. It just feels like the ATP 250s are the lower tier tournaments, but there is actually stuff below them. And, you know, players are grinding and fighting day in, day out. And I think up until last week, players were still doing Challenger Tours matches, which is absolutely insane. So, Vansh, why don't you start off with a few questions that you have prepared since you're probably the most prepared guy between all of us here.
No, I'm really not. I just really put this all together. It just fit in kind of nicely because, you know, I first want to ask Damian, you know, how did you become a tennis fan and, you know, what drew you to the Challenger Tour specifically? And, you know, you're considered by many on tennis Twitter to be a tennis hipster. So just tell us a little bit about that and your origin story and how that came about.
Yeah, I love that phrase, tennis hipster. I certainly identify with it for sure. How I became a tennis fan? Just watching some random matches on TV, I think my father was a big influence in that. He's definitely not as much of a tennis fan these days as I am, but just having someone to talk to about tennis and also watching Grand Slam finals was really helpful in the early days. There's been a few very important matches that showed me that this sport is so entertaining. The prime examples I could name is the Australian Open 2012 final between Djokovic and Nadal, and then also the Federer Del Potro Olympic semifinal. These were like the two, probably the first matches that I watched from start to finish. And then it just progressed with every single year. And as when it comes to Challengers specifically, back in like 2018, I was already like 19, so I could travel by myself and all without any issues. And I just figured I wanted to go to a live event. And in Poland, at the time, we didn't actually have any 250s or something like that. So Challengers was the best you could get. And I just traveled to Sopot in 2018. Actually, that edition was held in Gdynia, which is like very nearby, but never mind. And I loved it. I didn't like instantly start watching the Challenger Tour. I remember just following some streams Mostly the matches played by Poles, but I didn't really get into it that much instantly. But next year I traveled to Sopot again, then to Szczecin, and I just figured that, you know, with, you know, sort of looking for a way to get into the tennis media or however you want to call it, I just saw that there's really not much content on the Challenger Tour. Like, no one is talking about it. And I figured maybe I can do that. And by starting to, at first it was like a weekly recap piece of the Challenger Tour that I'm still actually writing, but it's like not my focus, and I'm not my most important work right now. But then it just my obsession grew stronger, I would say. And with every single week, I began to love that tour even more. And obviously, it was quite a shock for me how good these players are, because even in what commentators or pundits say, you often kind of get the feeling that they treat these players as journeymen, as, you know, people who basically cannot play. Like, they think that sub 120 in the rankings, there's pretty much, I don't know, that it's just wild and no one can actually, you know, no one actually has good technique or whatever. And it was quite a shock for me. And I guess I just like hipster stuff. I mean, something that isn't really talked about, something that I can, you know, be a pioneer of sorts. I don't know. I mean, an ambassador of this, you know, of the circuit of sorts, I guess I am. So, you know, I like that role. I'm gonna try to keep improving the content on the Challenger Tour that I put out, and hopefully get more interest in this circuit.
That's awesome. And you know, since you know the Challenger Tour so well, better than most, what would you say are the main differences between the Challenger Tour and the ATP?
A lot of the players say that there aren't any. I mean, I don't know if that's exactly true. For the most part, like, in terms of the playing quality, I guess it's just consistency, not necessarily talking of just putting the strokes in the court, but the way the players can just stay focused for, I don't know, a set, a longer period of time, a longer stretch of games. They can do that a lot more easily on the ATP Tour. Now, in Challengers, there's a lot more momentum shifts. In terms of technique, really, I mean, every single guy who plays on the Challenger Tour who's good enough has received years of training. So I don't think there's that much of a difference. I actually read a quote from Ramkumar Ramanathan like yesterday, who said that there's basically no difference between the levels. That's probably a bit of a stretch. But when you talk to any player who's on the Challenger Tour, he's just going to tell you that it doesn't really matter whether the opponent he's playing is ranked 120 or, I don't know, 450, that they can all play great, but they just cannot really do that every single day. And that's, I guess, the biggest difference that you can get between ATP Tour players and Challengers.
I feel like, just kind of like putting in like a little bit of a comment here. Like, when I watched Challengers at first, and obviously, like, as you very well put, like, the vast majority of tennis fans go into the sport via the biggest matches, right? So you watch Nadal versus Djokovic in a Grand Slam, and then you watch the Olympics between Roger Federer and Del Potro. And then, like, you kind of like worked your way down, I guess, towards the Challenger Tour. But when you go and you watch the highest level of tennis, and you go in and watch, like, the, you know, the less elite players, if you will, like, I feel like it's definitely interesting how many times I have noticed, like, and I feel like you put this perfectly, like, the momentum shifts, just like, they happen so much more often, and it gets frustrating even, like, as watching sometimes, like, when I see sometimes it's easy that they would crumble in the most important game, like when they have to close a set. I was watching a match then, like, I was getting really into it, like, especially this year I was covering a little bit more of a Canadian players. There's a bunch of them, like, playing on the Challenger Tour, like, day in, day out. And other players, sometimes, like, when you watch, sometimes they fail to serve for a match, and they played like five games in a row, like, on service, that they went like 40-15, 40-love. And they just failed to act, and they got broken, like, in the most important of the moments. And I feel like would just say that like maybe mental and not necessarily technical is definitely the thing that actually separates the ATP winners and the Challenger winners.
For sure. I mean, the mentality is everything here, I think. Just there's really not much difference in terms of technique or what they can produce. They just cannot do that in the most important moments. They cannot do that every single match. And that's probably the big difference. But you can get some absolutely stunning Challenger matches. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've been trying to tell people. Not yes. Everyone believes it, but some, you know, some like, you might have bad luck, obviously. There's going to be a lot more matches on the Challenger Tour that are going to be a little tough to watch if you're used to, you know, watching Djokovic and Nadal going at it. But it's really, I don't know, I guess I just really like seeing so many different players as well. I'm just not satisfied with the hundreds that are playing on the ATP Tour. I want to get to know another player. That's like, you know, when there's a new Challenger tournament and there's a guy whom I haven't seen, that's my priority. That's what I want to see. And I guess that would be actually true for a lot of people on the ATP Tour. I'm assuming there's going to be a lot of fans who think about it the same way.
Absolutely, yeah. That intrigue level is always, you know, always gets to the next level. Yeah. When you can, especially when you can be, you know, you can say like, you know, I watched this guy play 4 or 5 years ago, and I was like an early adopter of that player, if you will. I feel like a lot of people who follow the Challenger Tour, like yourself, you've been following the progression, you know, just level by level of these players, and it's probably great for you as a tennis fan. So, you know, just looking at it from that standpoint, you know, what do you think is the most fun part of Challengers for fans, you know, on site or online? You know, obviously now it's nice that we have ATP free streaming for the Challenger events. And so you can go and, you know, just check them out anytime. And there's usually Challengers, you know, pretty much every week. But how's that fan experience like for you?
Lots of matches, I guess. I mean, on the ATP Tour, you've got like, what, 40 or 50 events? And this year we've had 147 challengers. And as Andre said, you know, they finished on the 19th of December this year. So it's been pretty much, you know, sometimes you can just wake up to a tournament in Nur-Sultan or you know, somewhere in Asia. There weren't any in Australia or Asia this year. Australia is coming back. Asia, I'm talking of China, Japan and all. That would have been even more extreme. But some days you could, even this year, you could wake up to a tournament in Almaty and then finish the day at 3 a.m. in the morning for me, when I'm, you know, an American challenger or just a South American tournament. So that's really cool for me, because there's always tennis to be watched. And when I see people talking about how there's no tennis when you know, main tour events finish, that's where I step in and say, oh no, there is tennis. I actually have to stop myself from just, you know, just commenting on every single tweet like that, because people would kill me. But yeah, I think that the fact that you can watch so many matches a day, this week we've had a billion of weeks when there were 5 tournaments per week. In September, actually every single week had 5 of them. So it's super busy. You cannot watch it all. It's practically impossible. I watched probably like 95% of the finals this year, but it's just impossible to watch every single thing on any other day than Sunday, practically. And on Sunday, you still get a first round of qualifying. So because of focusing so much on the finals, I actually missed a lot of good first round qualifying action. So it's basically, you know, it never sleeps. And that's a great thing.
Nice. Right. Go ahead, Bunch.
No, I was just going to say, because this is actually perfect segue into, you know, another question we had is, you know, how do you think it can be better marketed to fans and the media? Because, you know, it's not helpful when you have, for example, the ATP chairman, Andrea Gaudenzi. I'm sure you probably saw, you know, 2 weeks ago, he put out this quote saying that, you know, on the Challenger Tour, you should be able to, you know, break even and pay your costs. And he sort of compared it to a university and said it was like an investment. And it's like, you know, after that, you kind of move on to the pro tour and then you have an actual job. And then he said that he doesn't think it'll be possible to have a sustainable tour at that level. because it lacks the interest of the fans and the engagement of the sponsors, broadcasters, and ticket revenues. So, you know, just wondering what your take was on that, and, you know, what you think, you know, how you think it can be sort of better marketed to fans and the mainstream media audience, so you don't have people going like, oh, there's no tennis, when there's actually, you know, a lot more tennis going on, stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really clear for years that the ATP doesn't think that challengers can be profitable for them. Mm-hmm. I just wish there was an attempt. I just feel like no one really tried. Obviously, it wouldn't really be mainstream. It would still be niche, but it probably doesn't have to be that niche. You mentioned ticket revenues. That's one I would really disagree with. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of countries that have insane crowds at challengers. Pretty much everything in South America, Italy, Germany, France, even Poland, for the matter, has wonderful crowds every time. Actually, I haven't seen these stats in a while, but back in 2019, the biggest challenger event in terms of how many people went there during the week was one in France. I can't remember which one, but it had 30,000 people. And I mean, that's a wonderful score that probably some ATP 250s wouldn't really be ashamed of. Obviously, in some countries, the interest is lower. France, Germany, Italy, South American things are, I mean, these are the ones that holds the most events. But ticket revenues, I think they're for the most part are actually kind of profitable for the organizers, but not necessarily for the ATP. And I can see that. How could it be better marketed? I'm going to use that example for like the umpteenth time, but I constantly get pissed off when I think about this video that the ATP, the Tennis TV channel on YouTube put out this year about Aslan Karatsev's rise. And they like literally started that story from St. Petersburg last year. St. Petersburg, the ATP 250 event where he lost to Kachanov, I think, in the second round. And there's some text on screen, and it pretty much makes it seem, it says that Karatsev was ranked well outside the top 100 and that he was given a wild card to this. And it basically makes, makes it seem like that wild card was just a random one for a Russian. It wasn't random at all. It came because he had this fantastic run in Czech challengers after the restart. He jumped 140 ranking places in 3 weeks. So, I mean, that just omitting that part in that video, and it's not a problem of rights, because they, I've seen Tennis TV using ATP Challenger Tour footage in their videos a lot. Actually, I think it's legal to use their footage in any video if what I asked about was, I mean, I asked about it a couple of weeks ago, and I think that was the answer.
Yeah, so. I'm pretty sure that all the footage that is ATP they own and they can use no matter how, pretty much. Like, there's obviously like some caveats here and there, but honestly, the Challenger Tour, I'm pretty sure there will be no objections about using that footage, to be honest.
Yeah, so I mean, it just made very little sense to me, because it was a great chance to market the Challenger Tour to the general public, just mention it, say, hey, there's tennis there. And in terms of whether it's just a university for the real job, I mean, there are so many different sports in the world, and some have this system of like, I don't know, there's 100 professional players and the others are just amateurs. Some, like football, have millions probably. Yeah, definitely millions of professional players worldwide. So, I mean, both systems are, you know, have their own have their own pluses and minuses, but obviously, as a fan of Challenger tennis, I would like more players to break even. It would also give them a little less incentive to fix, which shouldn't really be a reason that we should consider. But I mean, that's these financial struggles. It's actually also what people tend to like about the Challenger Tour, that the stakes are really high there. Like, you could really see the passion and how much the prize money means to these players. And it's so important. And you usually do it for challengers to get to these little steps, like, I don't know, being ranked about 230 to get into Grand Slam qualifying, being ranked about 110 to get into Grand Slam main draws, because that's where the money is. That just being indie spots can actually let you play a full season. And Challengers is not too profitable for the players at the moment, unless you're winning the events or going far in a few weeks each year. So I would love to see that changed. I don't know if it's ever possible, but I would really be... I just want someone to try. I feel like there's just not enough effort put into it. The streaming, as which you mentioned, many people still don't know about it. And that's also the fault of the marketing that the ATP does, because there's never really, like, for example, the ATP Challenger Tour Twitter account, it never really puts out the links to the matches before they happen or even after they happen. I think I saw them do it like once a month ago, but there's been some, I don't know, Andy Murray played Challenger Tour this year, right? That's twice even. So that's something that a lot of people would tune into. Still a lot of people tuned into it. I think it was like 6,000 viewers on the final he played against Marchenko in Biela, but 6,000 at one time, not in total, but still, I mean, that really could have been shared more extensively.
Yeah.
Yeah. You put out a piece today that sort of broke down the Challenger Tour this year by the numbers. And you wrote about the amount of tournaments that were on each surface. And I was surprised at how many there were on clay. There were 85 tournaments on clay to 58 on hard court. And as we know, the main ATP Tour is predominantly hard court. And I was wondering, do you think that breakdown is maybe not ideal for Challenger Tour players who are looking to break into the ATP eventually?
I mean, the balance used to be different. It's pretty much this year that we got this. I think I also mentioned that in the paragraph, that in 2019 and 2020, which is that's the third year in a row when I'm doing this piece. So, you know, I only have the stats for these 3 years, but it was 41% each,
right.
Each 2019 and 2020. So it's been different this year, I think largely due to the South American circuit. We've actually had something this year that hasn't really been done before, at least not since when I'm following, that a couple of events were, like, just interacted with each other. The Horacio de la Pena, actually the former ATP world number 31, I think, but you know him, he organized this tour in South America, and that was practically the reason why it's so dominant this year, because since, like, I can't remember the exact dates, but I think it was September, definitely at the end of September, from the end of September up until the middle of December, there was a South American Challenger every single week. Only one of them was on hard, the last one in Rio de Janeiro. So I think that was the reason why the balance was such. Is it ideal? I don't know. I mean, we've seen a few of these players like Juan Manuel Cerundolo or Sebastian Baez, who pretty much got their next gen finals spots only because of clay challengers. You know, the success rate has been a little iffy. Baez did well. Cerundolo certainly didn't. Baez has a much easier time translating his game to faster conditions. So it's, you know, on the main tour, they're going to be forced to play hard courts. So that might be, the transition might be tough for them. That's why I really wanted both of them to go to Milan, because, you know, they stayed in South America up until the week before. So many people were speculating whether they would even go because they had zero indoor hard court experience. But I guess, like, looking into the future, this experience will actually help them. And yeah, they probably will struggle still. Maybe Baez not, but I mean, Cerundolo will have a hard time if his ranking gets to a point where he cannot really play clay challengers all year. And he just, you know, on the main tour, the clay season is like, what, 4 months if you count the one after Wimbledon as well.
Yeah, I think in a way, though, like, obviously you put it like in different ways. There's definitely like an aspect of your ranking goes up. And if you win, say, for example, you win like 4 challengers in a row, like it doesn't have to be, you know, 4 weeks in a row, but like the 4 challenges that you play, you win. Like, it's obvious that your ranking will probably even like propulse you to like the top 100, where you'd be able to maybe enter even like make the cutoff for an ATP 250 with a more depleted field. So, and this will probably be an ATP hard court tournament event. But at the same time, like you mentioned, like Cerundolo and those guys, like they stayed pretty much in their continent of origin, or even in their country of origin. I think, wouldn't you think it's kind of like a little bit of a benefit in terms of the players to have so many challengers, even if it's on the same surface for them? Say, for example, if they never break into the top 100 or 150, the fact that they get to play only in the one surface maximizes their chances of like winning more often. And also the fact that they play only in the same country minimizes the cost of traveling and, you know, things like that. Like, it's probably a little bit more easily manageable. I've seen players, I was tracking a few players before, and when they were playing the Challenger Tour, pretty much they stayed in North America. So that's they've been touring around Chicago and New York, and so they barely even went the West Coast. So that probably means that they could even drive wherever they wanted to go, and that definitely would minimize the cost of like living, which would make I guess break even a little bit simpler than like traveling to Australia and then going back to Spain and then moving to Rio de Janeiro and then finishing like within 4 weeks you've traveled like in four different continents, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, Baez and Cerundolo, there was still a period this year when South America didn't hold any events. It actually had a lot of cancellations and delays because of COVID as well. And both Baez and Cerundolo went to Europe. I believe Cerundolo actually won all three of his challengers in Europe. So, I mean, they still had to travel. And there are these players who only play American challengers, yes. But in the long run, I think there's just not enough of them. America, like United States has been, I believe in 2019, they were actually the most prolific tournament holder on the Challenger Tour. And they massively fell down after COVID, both 2020 and 2021. So there actually hasn't been enough North American challengers for a player to, well, you can still, you know, get a ranking, get a high ranking if you actually win most of them, or I don't know, four of them, as you said. But I mean, who's going to do that? One or two players. Yeah. The others, if they want to get their rankings to a point where they can enter Grand Slams and all, they probably need to travel.
Yeah, I see.
That's a pretty good point. What I wanted to do was ask you, you know, so if you, what kind of things do you look for when you see an upcoming player, like, for example, breaking through on the Challenger Tour? And, you know, what do you look at in terms of assessing his potential as to how far he can go in the rankings, or, you know, what kind of breakthroughs he can make? For example, you've probably seen Carlos Alcaraz much before, you know, a lot of others have. So, like, you know, what kind of things do you assess? Like, for example, you know, I mean, obviously Alcaraz is a, seems like a different beast, just in terms of the way he's progressed. It's happened so quickly. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, it definitely happened so quickly. I mean, he's, ever since he was like 14 or 13, he's been breaking all the age records. I haven't seen him when he was in, hadn't seen him when he was like 13, but even back then people were talking about him and saying that he was going to be, going to be huge. And obviously he's fulfilling that. But in terms of what convinced me when I was looking at him, it's a really tough call usually, because so many things can go wrong in the development of a player, and it's so much easier to predict the potential of a player who has a lot of weapons, attacking playstyle, good serve. It's so much easier than actually, I don't know, Paolo Lorenzi or Victor Estrella Burgos, for example. They broke the top 100 after being over 30. And that's how it sort of works, that you cannot really predict the potential. Like, you can guess, but it's very hard to predict the potential of players whose, you know, biggest assets are consistency, great touch, something like that. You mostly look for weapons, and that's what makes all these, like you mentioned, the top 50 list they had, or just any other rankings or opinions that other players do, that other people on Twitter do, or I don't know, other people in the media do, that they just they're all in kind of inflated in favor of players who have a lot of weapons, who can be aggressive, who can have a great serve from an early age, who are really developed physically. Well, Alcaraz didn't have a good serve, but other than that, he definitely ticked all these boxes. Also, mental toughness, I guess, that was one of the big reasons why everyone was so, jumped on the bandwagon so early, because he was just a fortress in terms of the toughness and how he could still play his game in pretty much every single situation, and every single scoreline. So it's a tough job, and that's why I am really scared about that ranking that you mentioned, that top 50, because that, like, I believe there's gonna be some absurdly wrong things there when I look back at it in 5 years. Hopefully no one is gonna remember it.
You know, you mentioned how you think mental is a bigger aspect, like a bigger difference between the ATP and the Challenger Tour than technical. I was wondering, where do you think physical ranks in that? Because as far as I can tell, they don't play best of five on the Challenger Tour, right? Yep. And I think at the US Open, we saw a bunch of really young guys play really well. Like, we saw Holger Rune take a set off Djokovic. We saw Brooksby take a set off Djokovic. We saw Alcaraz make a really deep run. But Rune and Brooksby ended up sort of cramping and fading physically towards the end of their matches. And even Alcaraz, he ended up withdrawing mid-match. And I think that might have had something to do with the 2-5 setters he had just played. And so I was wondering, what do you think physically Challenger Tour players could do better, perhaps, to get ready for the main tour as they rise in the rankings?
We're definitely talking of younger players here. Yeah. So yeah, I believe that's also a factor. I haven't really been following the lower circuits for years or something. So it's probably this year was actually when I first started thinking about it. But Rune is an excellent example, because he was basically cramping in every single match he played, every single free set match he played in the early stages of the 2021 season. And then he sort of grew out of it. The Djokovic match was the last time I saw him cramping, probably. Another example would be Jack Draper, who retired like 5 times this year, mostly in the early days of his 2021 season. And right now, as he's really developed physically, it's not happening that often. So I believe that's also the physical growth that a player has to go through. It's a little bit of topic, but someone asked me recently, like, why do I think that women's Grand Slam junior champions do better in their transition to the pros? And I believe that's the reason is just basically physical biology. The fact that girls simply grow up earlier than boys. And when you see a 17 or a 16-year-old, or Runa was 18-year-old at the US Open, Brooksby was a bit older, of course. But when you see that young kids pretty much do so well, there's still so much growth and just development into their body that is to be done, that makes it also very hard to predict, and I guess also very hard for them to prepare for a 5-setter. It's just gonna get better with experience. What could the Challenger Tour do with this? I mean, the common trend in the tennis world is to stay away from 5-setters. I don't think we could really introduce best of five on the Challenger Tour. I don't know if that actually makes sense. I guess it's just something that everyone has to learn at some point. Obviously, a lot of the time you see these young players struggling, even not so young, not like Rune, I don't know, someone debuting in a Grand Slam, you see him struggling physically in the 5th set, and it's easy to just think that, well, he could have been prepared for this. He could have thought that maybe I'm going to play longer matches, just build up his stamina. But I guess it's just simply a completely different effort to actually play a match than to train hard for the same amount of play time, right? I mean, the stress on the muscles and on your brain as well is so much more intense that I don't think you can really be prepared for that. And I have no idea how the Challenger Tour would be able to fix it.
I guess, like, you touched on an interesting point here, that it obviously seems like the trend is like completely reversed nowadays, in which that in the 90s we've seen actually quite a bunch of like 18 year olds and 19 year olds like winning and winning big, not necessarily like Halyton Hewitt, who at 16 year old like won a 250, which is still pretty impressive, but like when you catch Michael Chang at 17 winning Roland Garros, like it's massive. But obviously it seems that there's a lot of difference in how people train nowadays, so that Roger Federer can go up to 38 years old and almost win Wimbledon, should have won Wimbledon pretty much, and now Djokovic and Nadal are like well in their 30s and pretty much still dominating. Nadal, aside from like a few unfortunate injuries that are not necessarily anything that has to do with his age, pretty much it's just like a chronic disease that he has on his foot that pretty much caused him to suffer this long. But I guess yeah, it's an interesting point that you put here. Like, and since we talked about the WTA, there's a question here that I find interesting. Like, do you think that the WTA can benefit from having challengers, or is there anything that is resembles a challenger? I think that the thing that most closely resembles it would be the WTA 125 that they have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I had in mind.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've heard from people who are more into the WTA tour that it's a little bit tougher for players outside the WTA tour to break through into it because of that you most of these breakthroughs are actually built on a good result on the main tour rather than, you know, some huge ITF success. Obviously there are a lot of players you could actually say did it differently. I don't know, Angelina Karolina is an example that came to mind right now. I don't know why, but I mean she won a billion of ITFs and now she's practically a main tier player. But I mean I believe they could implement something like that. It's great to just have that organization of the tour. As I said, 147 events, so a lot more playing opportunities. Because when you look at 125k events, it's like what, 9 per year or something like that. And these huge ITFs that they have, 100k's and all, there's just so much less tournaments that are actually, that are actually of the prize money and of the ranking points that are comparable to the Challenger Tour. I believe it makes it tougher to break through, tougher to rack up points, and they would probably benefit from a system like that as well.
Yeah, but do you think that they need, though, like in the sense, as you said, like the WTA players seem to be a lot younger and doing better, as you mentioned. It seems almost not necessarily that much of an issue for the WTA, I guess, since we got like, just look at the pool of players that we have nowadays, like in WTA. Like at any given Grand Slam, you could see like 30 players who have an actual shot at winning that tournament. Whereas for the men's tour, like it's like such a slow progression that you look at a Tsitsipas and you look at Alcaraz, and you're like, maybe in 3 or 4 years he can maybe reach like his first Grand Slam final, or like win a Grand Slam, or like getting to the top 5. It's something that is so much slower. Whereas on the WTA, that I feel like, as you mentioned, like, oh, they just had a breakthrough in the actual tour level tournaments. Maybe that's the reason why they don't have a system like that, or they never put in the effort to actually try and build one. The 125 might just be just enough, I guess, for these players.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think I know enough about the lower circuits of women's tennis to really give an answer to this. I've heard some voices that they would, I mean, they, I've heard some voices from fans that a system like the Challenger Tour would be beneficial, but I really have no actual way of confirming that. But you're absolutely right, obviously, that the pool of players that could win a big tournament on the women's side is just so much bigger. And there's that, just how often the players in the top 10 actually, you know, switch places, and how often someone new breaks through, like, not, you know, breaks through in the sense that she wins a big tournament or, you know, gets to the top 5 is just so much more frequent. That, yeah, I can see that as a good point in this discussion. Although, as I said, I'm afraid I do not know enough about the topic to really you know, have an opinion there.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, also in the ATP, sure. it's such a big progression sometimes for these young guys to then go and start playing multiple five setters, because like, you know, best of three and best of five, it's kind of a different animal in terms of just physically the output of like being able to reproduce that like seven times, you know. It just seems, this seems a lot harder to expect, you know, big Grand Slam breakthroughs right from the beginning. Whereas I think on the WTA, it's possibly a lesser of a transition just because of the, you know, the nature that it's all best of three, I guess. Mm. That would be,
I guess,
I was going to say, I think also on the WTA, the players tend to have completely mature games much earlier in their careers, like at the US Open. Raducanu and Fernandez really didn't have any weaknesses. And I think that was one of the reasons why it was so jarring that Alcaraz also kind of had no weaknesses, because there are players many years above him who have who still have holes in their game. Like, we know many of the next gens who have been pretty successful don't have great return games, and Alcaraz did at such a young age.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. That's why he's touted as this absolute huge prospect. And I mean, people often forget that. I'm not really saying that he's going to win Roland Garros 2022, but I mean, Nadal was like 19. I think he turned 19 during the
middle
2005
of the tournament,
French Open. Yeah. So I mean, he's still.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
On the route to getting there, I mean, I'm not saying he's going to do it. As you said, the peak of a tennis player has actually just completely the ages in which a tennis player peaks have completely changed this year, these past few decades, probably not, but I mean these last 20 years or so, everyone is, especially as we said on the ATP tour, but I mean in the women's as well, you don't really get 15-year-olds winning Grand Slams anymore,
right?
Yeah, I think that's right. A great point. I mean, with the legends we have on tour right now, it seems like it takes more, like a higher level to win a major now than it did in years past, maybe. And yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why it's so impressive that Alcaraz has been so successful at 18. Because when you look back at Michael Chang, like Andre was mentioning, winning a major at 17, imagining that happening now is just crazy, because you need the physical development and you need to not have holes in your game and you need to be so mentally tough. And I'm curious when that's going to happen again on the men's side, if it ever happens, because I think we could still be several decades away from that.
Yeah, racket technology as well, right? I mean, it all leads to more grueling rallies, the tennis being more physical. Obviously, you could talk about how in the 90s, I know, Wimbledon was so fast that all the rallies were three or five shots, and there were, you know, carpet surfaces. These are the courts that we could really imagine, I don't know, a 17-year-old player winning something huge, because that's where the physicality doesn't matter that much. But in these days of slightly slower surfaces, also the homogenization, I guess, between the surfaces, which is sort of evident, it's going to be tougher and tougher probably. Yeah.
And really quickly, how do you feel about like this trend that the game has taken? Like, do you think the current state of the game is better than it was in the 90s? Like, do you think tennis is moving in a good direction and that these grueling rallies are a good thing?
I mean, the medicine is also progressing, so I guess that's not that, you know, the health impact of that can be somewhat mitigated. In general, I love attacking styles. I love serve and volley. I love players going to the net. But I think part of why I enjoy it so much is that it's rare. I believe if every single match looked like this, it would probably somewhat hamper my enjoyment. Even some of the matches I saw, obviously not, I haven't really seen that many of matches from Wimbledon 19 something, but I mean, I saw a few of them, and they at some points got a little hard to watch when both players were serving volleying, and every single, especially when there was someone who served really well and every single point was like, you know, serve, missed return, the missed return, then a serve, volley finish. I mean, I love it when it happens, when it's a rarity, when it's something fresh in how the dynamics of the matchup are going. But I believe that is probably the current state is probably a lot better for TV, for fans, for the players, I guess. That there are so many, I guess that there's not that many random results that you could sort of get on faster surfaces. I feel like it's a very common conception that that on grass some matches can just or faster indoor hard courts the matches can get a little bit more random with the serves needing tie breaks. But then again, I mean, Pete Sampras won Wimbledon 7 times, so what randomness was there really?
Yeah, I guess so. Now we can get to the really exciting part of this podcast, which is talk about all the players that had success in 2021, and you know what can we sort of expect from these players in 2022. I mean, we saw great runs from one guy that I really want to talk about is Talon Griekspoor, because I mean, he won 8 challengers this year, is that right? Like, that's some kind of a crazy record, right? Like,
it is, yes, it was 6 before happened. This year, and Talon got it to 8, which by the way I think is pretty much a result of the ranking freeze as well. It just kept him in the, you know, in these spots where he actually needed to play challenger events for a little while longer. And it's a record that might be unattainable, really. Yeah. I mean, he's still on a 25 match win streak in challengers, I think 26 in total, because there was also a Davis Cup match. But if you're asking about Griekspoor, I think he can do just fine on the main tour. I don't want to be disrespectful to Botik van de Zandschulp, but I've always sort of mentioned that I don't think like that his US Open quarterfinal run, like if you actually swapped the positions between Griekspoor and van de Zandschulp, I don't know if Griekspoor beats Schwartzman, but in the form that he was at the end of the season, I think he was just as capable of going to the quarterfinals or to the fourth round at the US Open. No, he ran into Djokovic, so there's not really much you can do there. But this is a guy who clearly has the weapons to compete with all these guys on the main tour. Fantastic serve, fantastic forehand. And I mean, even this year, at the start of the season, he played in Montpellier, he played in Acapulco, and did very well. And I just believe he can very easily compete there. Sometimes it's harder to break through to the main tour than to than to actually stay there, I think. I believe a lot of the players who are ranked, I don't know, around 120, 130, if you actually gave them a chance to play the main tour for like 8 months, which is probably what Talon is gonna get, because another aspect of his run was that he won his first challenger this year in May. So he pretty much won these 8 in 7 months, right? May to November would be 7. So it's going to be some time before the points start dropping. And I believe there are a lot of players who, if you gave them the chance to play the main tour for a prolonged period, they can actually be very competitive there. And Talon is certainly one of them for me. I hope the form hasn't, you know, gone away in any way. Because the you know, the 25 wins that he got in a row, it was absolutely spectacular. Also, changing surfaces, indoor hard, outdoor hard, and free on clay. So it also demonstrates that he should be able to do just fine, honestly.
Something I was so impressed with on Griekspoor's part was I watched him play Djokovic at the US Open. And, you know, as we know, Djokovic is just a nightmare opponent to play. He's going to attack all your weaknesses. And he won in straight sets. And I was thinking, something I think about usually is, even in the high ranks on the ATP, like for a guy like Rublev, I think he's kind of still multiple steps away from the top of the game. Like, he's yet to play a late match in a major, like semifinal or final. And he's also yet to get a really big breakthrough win. And sometimes I think, you know, for a challenger tour player, it would be even more difficult because you would be several steps away from the top. And so I was thinking from on the part of Greek Sport, it would be kind of hard to have positive takeaways from that US Open match, which was why I was so amazed he's on this winning streak now. And so do you think for challenger tour players, this is something like a mindset they have to deal with or an obstacle they have to get past?
I mean, when you're 25 and only breaking through to the top 100, you cannot really be expecting to win slams, I guess. I mean, this hasn't really happened, but we have guys like Aslan Karatsev who got to a semifinal of a slam. You know, if you told me that, I don't know, 6 months earlier or even a week before the Australian Open, let's be honest, yeah, I would never believe it, right? So he kind of proved that with great form and challengers, then some good signs, I guess, on the main tour. He had that second round of St. Petersburg that we mentioned, also a great campaign in the qualies, but I mean, nothing to indicate that he was capable of such a run. Mm-hmm. But as we mentioned that before, that it's so hard to win a major in this era on the men's side, which, you know, we have like eight with Medvedev, right? Eight active Grand Slam champions, something like that. So so it's just gonna be very hard to get from that quarterfinal, which Van de Zandschulp did, at the semifinal, which Karatsev did, or the multiple quarterfinals that Rublev had, to get from there to actually winning one is going to be really hard, yes. Because it takes you actually have to win against these mammoth unbeatable players, either the old big three or the, you know, what you could call the new big three. You're going to have to actually beat them. And for most players, it's just impossible. In the example of Rublev, I mean, he just really has a very poor matchup against Medvedev and Zverev, right? So it's, he really needs to get that sorted out. That's when he can go for a slam. Unless he has a lot of luck and everyone just loses early. But...
So yeah. Would you say that a good progression for a challenger player who actually has chances in the ATP and actually build it up and actually get there? I feel like their best chances would be obviously the 250s and a 500. Would you say it's something that they can do as well?
I mean, I guess all examples are individual, but
yeah,
other than these early breakthroughs like Alcaraz or Rune, who I believe certainly could be winning bigger titles soon, maybe not this year. I mean, I'm talking about 2022, but maybe a bit later. But in terms of most of the players, I guess 250s is what I'm looking at. Yes, the recent. Most of the recent breakthroughs like Cerundolo, Greek Sport. I don't know about Sebastian Baez. I think there might be more potential there. But I think every single example is just really, you know, supposed to be looked at individually here.
Hmm.
So I guess let's talk about Rune. So Rune, you know, he started the year, what, like outside the top
474, I think.
Yeah, and now he's just outside the top 100. And I guess, you know, technically he had a top 100 year because he finished in the race, he was a lot higher, right? And he finished like in around 70-ish, something like that. So,
yeah,
you know,
something like that, yeah.
So what do we think about his chances in 2022? Because obviously, clearly physically, he played, I think, 130 matches since the restart, something like that, which is insane. And we already talked about the cramping and, you know, the physical maturing that he's kind of had to do to overcome this. But, you know, and obviously with the help of several wild cards that helped him get into a lot of these ATP events. But clearly, I think, you know, certainly the potential is there, right, for him to become a...
Well, of course. I mean, it's easy to forget that he's just 18, actually. Yeah, and that he... you know, he set this goal for himself to get to the top 100. That's why he played so much. I don't know if it was wise. He was obviously very salty about not getting there. Yeah. And he showed it in a few, and I can't remember, tweets. I think it was tweets, right?
Where he commented on the Instagram saying, like, I guess my ranking jump wasn't enough to get most improved.
Most improved, yes. But there was also a tweet saying that because of the ranking freeze, his progress is hampered and that he cannot get to 100. But I think his attitude is actually part of what really sells him to me, like as a player, because I believe in order to be the, you know, ever a top player, an elite guy, you actually need to be sort of crazy in that sense, to have that belief that you can actually be that world number one. Or he has that famous quote where he said that he's gonna win more French Opens than Nadal. Like, I don't doubt that he actually believes that. Like, and that's the sort of mentality that can get you there. And he's obviously a wonderful talent. A French Open junior Grand Slam champion as well.
Yeah.
And I remember him in the like early 2020 when he was getting these wild cards, and they actually weren't warranted by any results, anything he was showing. And I think this is one of the players for whom the pandemic was actually came at the very right time. This is a very, I don't know if I can swear here, so I'm not going to say the word I just wanted to. I just wanted to say, but it's obviously not a great thing for me to say. But for Rune's progress, it was actually quite perfect, because he had all these wildcards locked up for the spring of 2020. Alcaraz the same pretty much. And after the restart, they just went straight to lower tournaments. Alcaraz went to challengers. Rune had to start from ITFs. And by actually getting the match practice, getting the, you know, getting to play a lot more professionally than he would losing in the first rounds of ATP 250s or something, he actually developed his game a lot, especially in terms of the power. This is actually, I forgot to mention it when you were asking about what do I look at in terms of the player's potential, but how they do on different surfaces is definitely also... also the one of the keys for sure, and Rune can certainly, I mean, grass is such a novelty, I don't really look at it, so it's just mostly hard courts, indoor and clay. I even talked to Rune this year about it, and he was also very very self-assured as always, but he kept saying that, I mean, that he likes both hard courts and clay courts. Hard because he can play very close to the baseline, and clay courts because he hits a very heavy ball. And it's a really great combination. And even the match against Djokovic in New York, which I guess there were just two sets, because the sets 3 and 4 cannot really be talked about in any way, because it was just Rune cramping. But that's little sort of early showing against an all-time great was also very reassuring in terms of his potential. He was on an 18 match win streak at that time, I think, something like that. Or maybe 13. 13, I think.
Yeah.
Two challengers and the qualies. So that might be 18. I don't know. It doesn't really matter, obviously. But anyhow, I mean, yeah, I am certainly very big on this guy and really expecting him. Maybe not this year, but I would be shocked if he's not just a full-time main tour player by the end of next season. He clearly should be a top 100 player. I'm not a fan of the ranking freeze. I think, I mean, I get what they were trying to achieve in the very beginning, but later when there were so many events held anyway, it sort of lost its purpose. And I just checked that he's 67th in the race. And that's clearly a more accurate position than the 104th that you can see him at in the ATP rankings.
Right. Yeah. I think I watched a little bit of him after the US Open. I watched him in Metz, where he beat Sonego. I think that was his best win so far. He beat Sonego, and then he played a really tight match against PCB. And so I was like, okay, wow, this guy is really could be a mainstay here at the tour, like very quickly, though.
Yes, and before this event, no one was actually really sure if Rune is going to play well indoors. And I mean, then he just came to Metz, and as you said, won 4 matches, because I believe he was starting from the qualies as well. Had a fantastic game against Karim Busta, then also won an indoor challenger later. Played quite well at the next gen finals as well. He lost to Alcaraz and Nakashima, right? So that's definitely, you know, not bad losses. And he's obviously younger than Nakashima by like 2 years or something. Okay. So yeah, I mean, huge potential. One of the guys who could actually win a slam. And, you know, okay, let's start with the outrageous predictions that are so early. that they, you know, that they have pretty much zero ground. But I mean, I'm gonna say Holger Rune wins the slam in his career. Okay. Let's go.
We'll timestamp this in the description and retweet it every day so cross references for the rest of his career. No, but I really loved the point you made about how top athletes kind of have to be crazy, and that Rune quote about the French Opens. I mean, I don't think anyone thinks he's going to do it, but it reminded me of what Djokovic said at the 2006 French Open when he's like, you know, Nadal is the best on clay, but he's beatable. And at the time, everyone made fun of Djokovic, but now look at where he is 15 and a half years later, the only guy to beat Nadal at the French Open twice. So I completely agree with you that having that mindset is almost a necessity for a top athlete.
When Söderling said after that Nadal match in Rome that it was actually kind of close.
He lost it
6-1, 6-0. Everyone laughed. And then 2 weeks later, no one was laughing anymore. Yeah, this is the kind of mentality that you need to have, because I believe so many players just enter the tour with the, you know, kind of thinking, okay, I mean, maybe I can get to top 50. That would be a good career. An ATP title would be nice. No, Rune just wants it all. And maybe he's going to flop, but this is the kind of mentality that will really drive him towards working harder. It might not get him friends. There are so many fans already that dislike him for his antics. I mean, I don't really care. He's entertaining. Yeah. When I talked to him, he was very nice as well. But I saw him, you know, there was this one homophobia, I don't know how to call it, incident. There's some problematic stuff, of course, but he's certainly a character, that's for sure.
I think it's I've been reading The Master right now, and we all know about Roger Federer's career, right? But it's super easy in hindsight, like, especially, like, there's many interviews with people that are just like, oh yeah, like, as soon as I saw the guy, I was like, this guy's gonna be something. And you always take a few of those as a grain of salt. It was like, yeah, of course, like you say that now that he's won 20 grand slams and been like number one for this many weeks, but like right now, like you said, like Rune is gonna win his slam, and that alone for yourself is a crazy take. And it's just that much difficult to say like somebody's gonna be something in their careers, like no matter how crazy they are. I remember Dolgopolov was saying like he wanted to be number one, and that was like his goal. He never even got it even close. I don't think he's ever even been a top 10 player.
No, 13 or something like that.
Yeah. So yeah, like it's you have to be crazy. Obviously, you have to be good too. Like you have to put the balls in and like win matches to be number one. There is plenty of crazy people in the world. But if you were actually to say like put your foot on the ground and look at somebody in the Challenger Tour and like say like this person, or even like him, like a lower like ATP player, like at this point, like who would you say has, I guess, the best potential to actually be something? And when I say be something, and it's not like, because top 20 and like top 50, 30 is a good career, but like to be something is like a top three, top five player, potentially Grand Slam finalists.
I don't want to answer the same thing, but I mean, Holger Rune, yes.
Yeah.
That's certainly, I believe, that the biggest talent that we have right now outside of guys like Alcaraz, because I'm discounting Alcaraz because he's obviously going to be amazing. And I mean, if he got so far this early, we still can't really predict it. But I mean, everyone would agree right now that it would be a huge shock if he never, I don't know, reached the top 10 or something like that. Rune is one for sure. It's so hard to tell with the other guys because there are a few names in my head, but it's so hard to tell the difference between a future top 10 player and a future, I don't know, top 50 guy. It's just practically impossible. You mentioned Federer, and I guess the people that were talking about this, they probably thought of his Wimbledon junior success. Also, he won the Orange Ball, I think. But then from that point forward, there was a point in his career when he actually wasn't even developing that well, right? It actually took him some time. So it's just so hard to tell, honestly. But if I have to name one guy, I would stick by what I said about Rune, yes. Discounting Alcaraz, as I said. But who else was there, like who is already on the main tour but it's still not there? I mean, I don't think Brooksby has a Grand Slam winning game. it's very unique. It will take him far, but probably not. I'm just looking at the rankings right now, because most of the guys that come into my head are very young, just far back still, and it is just impossible. I could make predictions like they can be in the top 100. Sebastian Baez sort of comes to mind for me as well. I guess that's a guy who should probably have that sort of potential, but as I said, it's always a lot tougher to predict the ceiling of guys who, you know, aren't necessarily that aggressive. He is, but in his own way. When you let him on clay, he can dictate the point with the forehand, of course, but he's not that sort of hot shot as Alcaraz is, right? So many people use that comparison to Diego Schwartzman when talking about Baez. He's gonna be. I actually, you know, feel sorry for him, because for the, I'm presuming, unless he wins a slam or something, for the most of, you know, for the majority of his career, he's gonna hear that every day, that he's like Diego Schwartzman, just because they're small Argentinians and like clay, I guess. That's pretty much
baby fed 2.0.
Yeah,
he does seem to do more with his forehand,
and definitely,
attack more with it, like. You know, I think Diego can, but it's more out of his comfort zone, and he's, Baez, I watched him a little bit in the next gen finals. He was taking the ball quite early. He was trying to come forward, finish points. Seemed like he was having a decent success rate for a guy who hadn't had much indoor hard court experience. I thought he was dealing with it, you know, arguably the best out of like him and Cerundolo and the others. I felt
for
like
sure. He only had one indoor hardcourt match before this event. Right. I believe it was an ITF somewhere. I can't remember, a loss, obviously. But he was also great at the US Open. So he can clearly translate his game from clay well to hardcourts. And I think a big part of that is what you said about his forehand, that he definitely does more with it than for example, Schwartzman does.
Yeah.
But then again, let's pretend that this comparison is great for a moment. And was Diego Schwartzman an easy player to predict? Like, in the sense that was this guy that would get to the top 10?
Not at all. Like, I watched him play the first time against Federer in 2015 in Indian Wells. I saw that live, and I was thinking, no way, no way he's not going to, there's no way he's going to be a top 10 guy, you know? And then he had great results at the end of 2020, which sort of propelled him there, like in Rome and reaching the semis of Roland Garros. Obviously, he beat Rafa. He beat Thiem in Roland Garros. So,
yeah, so I mean, I've heard some. I've heard some stories. I wasn't really attending these events back in like 2013 or something, but I've heard some stories from the Polish challengers where Schwartzman played in Szczecin, I believe, in 2013. I've heard of some random. Well, I mean, they weren't random at the time, but at this right now, you could just call them random Polish players who never actually achieved anything, and they were laughing off Schwartzman's second serve, saying, "You know, this is just like a balloon; you can just hit through it." And I mean, if they knew at the time what Diego Schwartzman was going to become. But that's sort of the point that I made earlier, that for players like that, it's just very hard to tell from an early age that they're going to be so good. I don't know if that's even an argument, but it was, even though I don't like that comparison between Baez and Schwartzman, like Schwartzman's success sort of tells me that, I mean, that there is a possibility for a guy like Baez to go far in this sport, that his physicality doesn't necessarily mean that that he's going to struggle. And as you said, the way he played at the Next Gen Finals, also the US Open, was really reassuring of that as well.
Yeah. Something I'm interested to see what happens in this era is, once the big three are completely out of the door, what player who's kind of like David Ferrer-esque is going to end up winning a major? Because there are still guys with big games around, but they don't have the same level of consistency. So I'm quite excited to see like which player who's maybe more of a grinder, has fewer weapons or a bit more of a limited game. Someone like Brooksby, will someone like that end up winning a major? And like, where will it happen if it does?
You're definitely thinking of a repetition of a Carlos Moya or a Thomas Muster here.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah. No.
Yeah, I mean, because I think this is a bit off topic, but I think once Djokovic and Nadal are out, Roland Garros and Wimbledon could become like crapshoots on the men's side a little bit, especially Wimbledon, because there are just no grass specialists anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah. Berrettini is probably the
only.
So many times I see people just saying that Berrettini has no chance to win a slam because he has that hole in his game. Right. And then I'm just like, look at this year's Wimbledon.
He was so close.
If it wasn't Djokovic in the finals, I don't think there was a player that could stop him there.
Yeah.
Medvedev could potentially be a huge grass court player as well, just because of how flat he plays. He's going to be a nightmare to play on these lower bouncing courts, but I guess he's not there yet. And the others just don't really like grass that much. Yeah, grass is going to be very open for sure, unless someone new steps up. But then it's so hard for new players even to step up because they have zero grass court experience, right?
Yeah.
I know, maybe so the British ones.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
some Brits like Jack Draper, for example. I mean, it's a very random shout, but I mean, Brits at least have grass court experience. Australians probably, Americans as well. Other than that, no one plays on grass in their youth.
Yeah. Actually, when you said Berrettini, it kind of reminded me of one other player that I think is forgotten a little bit in 2021 because he had a good Roland Garros in 2020. And obviously we know Musetti, he got to the fourth round of Roland Garros this year, but I remember, the player that came to my mind was Daniel Altmaier. He beat Berrettini last year in Roland Garros in straight sets, and then he lost to Krajina Busta, I think. And then this year he won a couple of challengers and he played well in one of the clay court events after Wimbledon. I think he got to a semi there.
Umag,
that was the tournament. Yeah. And so, you know, what do we think about his potential? I feel like he can do some damage next year on clay and, you know, maybe win an ATP 250 or because he's now, I think, ranked at 83 in the world. So.
It was kind of shocking last year, right? Someone outside of the top 100 can do this well at Roland Garros. And it's great that he finally managed to get there this year. And we're just going to see him a lot on the main tour this year. Also a very big game, one-handed backhand, which some of us like, some of us don't. but it's not that flashy. I think I think mostly it's just really consistently powerful as all his game is.
Yeah, I guess it could be like a new Wawrinka or whatever.
He points to his head like this. I think Wawrinka was actually his idol. That's what he said, I think, during that tournament. So,
Cool. Yeah. Well, Wawrinka beat Djokovic twice in five sets, so why not? I guess like to try to like bring things to an end. Obviously, the Challenger Tour is so vast and so extensive that we could literally just have a podcast about it. Which, if you're interested, let me know. I guess I really like this question. You don't even need to bring any stats into it. Just kind of, what is your wildest, most boldest take for 2022? Like, forget about the stat sheets. Just pick a player and say Nadal is going to lose to that guy.
It can be any level. Challengers, ATP, WTA, whatever you want. We all have an outrageous take that's going to age like milk, but that's fine, you know?
Yes. Do you have yours? Maybe I can get just, you know, I'm looking to get some, I don't know, 15 seconds to think about it or something.
I mean, I don't have one for next year, but if it makes you feel any better, I was boldly claiming that Medvedev was going to have beat Djokovic in the Australian Open final this year, and then he just got destroyed.
Did you claim that before the event started or
Once they got to the final? I think beforehand I said he was
I was saying the same thing. Colleague asked me like who is gonna win this. He's like, just, you know, barely a tennis fan, he watches some big matches, and I remember just giving him a lecture about why Medvedev is gonna win this.
And then he
never really arrived.
I was so confident. Yeah. And then like in the middle of the second set, I was just like, no, this is really, really bad. And then just...
That aged totally very, very poorly, even in the middle of the match.
Yeah.
you guys weren't alone. I mean, the odds makers had Medvedev as a slight favorite.
For sure, yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, I definitely thought it was going to be like a top four setter at the least. So yeah. I was definitely very impressed. Like, I guess I had a very bold take back in 2020 when there was no tennis anyways. But like I claimed that Federer would come back to win Wimbledon one last time.
I remember listening to that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely had the injuries, which kind of like lingered on for a little longer than I expected they would, but I think it was still a pretty bold take considering everything. If I'm going to take one bold take, I'm going to say that Djokovic doesn't win a single slam in 2022. They're all going to go elsewhere.
Andre, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
This is going to be my bold take. It doesn't mean that I believe it. It's just like that gut feeling. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So mine was that he wasn't going to finish the year number one, which I don't think is that bold, honestly. I have Medvedev finishing the year number one next year. I just feel like, you know, he can make a lot more progress on clay than he did this year because
for sure.
I think a lot of his struggles were mental, for being honest, on clay. Like, he didn't play on clay, for sure.
But the French clay definitely was also better for him, right? It just played more like hard courts.
That's true. The conditions really helped him out this year. Mm-hmm,
for sure.
And yeah, that match against Tsitsipas was good. Although the underhand serve was...
That was a low point.
Yeah. And, you know, grass is going to be tough, but I feel like if he can adjust his return position a little bit, you know, because he stands so far back on grass. And if he can move up a little bit and take some of those returns early and just has that option, then I feel like, you know, in that match against Hurkacz, I mean, if that was played the same day, I feel like he would have won it because it was 2-1 up and he was leading 4-3 in the fourth set. And then, you know, then the match was moved the next day and it was on center court and just got thrown off a bit. But I feel like he's definitely has the game to do better on grass than he did this year. And then already on hard court, he's such a beast and he has one of the best return serve combinations I've ever seen, really. So I feel like, and then Djokovic, even though he won 3 slams this year and got to the final of the fourth, it was still somewhat of a race at the end of the year, you know, with like Indian Wells. It felt like, you know, if Medvedev had to have won like everything and Djokovic would have had to flop a little bit, you know, he could have taken that year on the spot. So I feel like with the amount that Djokovic is going to play this year, you know, with like his scheduling, he's going to tailor it down a bit. And now he's already had those records and, you know, he's had 7 year on number ones. And if you just go back in history, like after Sampras did his 6 year as number one, you know, then in 1999, he had a big dip. And, you know, same with the big three at points in their stages in their career. So I feel like maybe the time is coming now where, you know, obviously I think Djokovic is still going to be in the top three, probably number two, but I think I have Medvedev finishing the year number one. I don't even know if that's a really bold take, to be honest. I feel like it's not that bold.
You'd be bold if you say Tsitsipas, but...
Yeah, I mean, it is possible. Yeah, I mean, all right, Damien, that was way more than 15 seconds. What do you have for us?
One thing I wanted to say was that it may be that, you know, this year, the calendar slam was such a big goal for Djokovic. So let's imagine he loses at the Australian Open. Then I don't know how motivated he's going to be for the next 3 slams, in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe to get 21, but after that...
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah,
but anyhow, yeah, I don't know if it's bold, but I'm gonna say that either one of these two is gonna win the French Open next year, and it's gonna be Casper Ruud or Stefanos Tsitsipas.
Dang, okay. That is pretty bold.
Okay, that's bold. I mean, yeah. Tsitsipas is
was one set away. I think there's something to that. Yeah.
Well, never a set felt so far away though, but like still, he was just one set away.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, he had an amazing clay season from start to finish.
He was really good. Casper would be really, really impressive.
Yeah.
I think nobody would see that coming.
I mean, it's possible, but just the way he performed at the Grand Slams for now is like the only thing stopping me from maybe not saying that Casper Ruud is going to win the French Open, but I think in the future, he's going to be a contender for it.
For sure.
Yeah.
And Tsitsipas, as you said, had a fantastic clay season. And I just really loved how he can hide that weaker backhand on clay. For example,
on the return.
Yes, on the return, especially in that final against Rublev in Monte Carlo, I think he hit all but three of his second serve returns from the forehand because he was running around it all. And if he can do that, and I don't know, I mean, it's very possible. I just don't think, you know, there's a lot of question marks about Nadal. And I would also, I'm definitely not expecting Djokovic to win a calendar slam or I'm not sure if I would go as far as Andre did, but I mean, I am expecting him to have a worse season. But like anything, pretty much anything is a worse season after 2021 that Djokovic had. So,
Yeah. I mean, the thing that interests me about Djokovic is I think at this point in time, he's now a bigger favorite at Wimbledon than he is at the Australian Open, even though at the Australian Open, he's been way more dominant over the years.
I agree. Yeah. I think he's a bigger favorite.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, as we said, I mean, there's just not many grass court players right now, and Djokovic can clearly do extremely well on this surface, even though his style is not really what you usually
think of a grass court player.
Yeah,
exactly. And I don't necessarily know what that shows about the generation that we are actually seeing right now, but it might be a cue that grass court prowess is definitely lacking. Nothing to take away from Djokovic. You don't win 6 Wimbledons without being a good grass court player. But at the same time, Roger Federer, 37 or 5, making the Wimbledon final and very nearly winning it, it definitely is interesting, in the grand scheme of things. But other than that, thanks. Now that we've finished this Challenger podcast by talking about Wimbledon, thanks, Damien, for coming by our podcast. So you're obviously always welcome. Can you share where can people follow you and read your work?
You can follow me on Twitter. It's just my first name and surname. I am a freelancer, I guess you could call it. So I am featured on some different websites, like, for example, Last Word in Tennis or Cracked Rackets, or right now at Popcorn Tennis, which I think we're all featured at, right?
Yep.
Am I right? Yes. So you can definitely catch me there from, well, not, I wanted to say from time to time. You can catch me there, my pieces or I don't know, a podcast I have on the Challenger Tour, by the way. Let me just, get that into the air. If someone listened to this and wants to learn so much about the Challenger Tour, then you can also listen to the podcast I have just specifically on this topic. But I don't like talking about myself too much, so that's where I'm going to finish at. Thanks for inviting me. It was a lot of fun. Yeah, we definitely covered so many different topics, not necessarily related to the Challenger Tour, but I mean, I don't mind that. It was very interesting, and just the way we sort of, went from a big take about how tennis changed from the 90s to a random 150 ranked player. That was something.
Yeah. We like to keep it wild and entertaining. Roller coaster ride of
nobody tennis. Knows what to expect to the tennis
amigos.
Yeah. Yeah. But thanks for joining us, and we'll have to do this again soon.
Yeah. It was a blast. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, guys, so much. See you guys later. And for the listeners, thanks for listening. And have a great new year if this episode comes out soon enough. I think it should be about the 30th or 31st when you'll be listening to this. Enjoy tennis coming back soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.